This is Red Ice Radio. I'm your host, Henrik Palmgren, editor over at red-ice.net. I'm coming to you live all the way from Sweden and wherever you are. It's great to have you here and tuned in to bbsradio.com. So today we got another information-packed radio program ready for you. We have Michael Tsarion back with us on the program. And if you are new to all this, let me just briefly mention that we are currently featuring a six-part series with Michael, primarily oriented around the information about Akhenaten, the cult of Aten, how it all connects from the ancient world up to our new world order, Freemasonry and the Illuminati. It's about the pharaohs of Egypt and how this story has been handed down to us through the Bible and them being portrayed as Israelite biblical characters. And we will also continue with our contest today. And we want to hand out another DVD from Michael's excellent Origins and Oracles DVD series. So that's coming up in about 40 minutes or so. So stay tuned for that, and we'll be giving out the question and the phone numbers that you should call and so forth. And for much more information about Michael, make sure to check out his websites, michaeltesarion.com, taroscopes.com, and also his DVD series site, originsandoracles.com. And Michael, welcome back. And I don't know if you find this relevant, but I just want to ask you, we are fast approaching the five-year anniversary of 9/11, and do you think that the Atenists are you know, happy with the timetable of where we are at, considering all that has happened in these past 5 years?
Well, I mean, it depends. It's hard to put yourself in the place of these people, but if I was them, I would be more than happy with the way that things are going, because, you know, as we said on a previous program, hardly a breath is taken before there's another war or another conflict. And, of course, if you were one of them and you looked around at the dumbed-down state of most human beings, you're up in the 90% mark there, you know, with the amount of control that they exert, even though we've spoken about the fact that, you know, there are a lot of people waking up slowly.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I would find that, you know, you know, I don't think that they're particularly perturbed. I think that what might be, you know, of concern to them, which has been a concern for many thousands of years, is nature's cycle. The idea that there are certain physical laws that change.
Yeah.
You know, that the historians even are talking about the declines of civilization. You know, there are wider metaphysical, you know, phenomena.
Yeah, indeed.
That I think these people take very seriously. And, of course, in the back of their minds, they always know that there is a threat from the human race. It's part of the reason why they've been so restrictive with the middle classes throughout the world, is they want to get rid of the middle class because they know that the middle class is educated, is a little bit, you know, better off than the average slave that's been used to for many millennia.
Yeah.
And the working class has the free time to start working out something about the systems of control in the world. But other than that, I don't think, you know, these people have any major concerns, you know. I mean, I may be wrong. I mean, we've just heard that the head Jesuit, you know, is standing down for the first time ever.
Okay, what's this about?
Koldenbeck. I think it's Hans Koldenbeck.
Oh, okay.
He's standing down. But you see, again, you know, I don't know, that might be, people can interpret him standing down from power as a sign that, you know, they're losing their power or something, you know, but again, there doesn't seem to be much reason for that, really.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to judge, you know.
Yeah.
I think if I was them, I'd be pretty happy with the way things are going. If you judge it in, like I say, the pretty much dumbed-downness of the human race, the fact that they're in total turmoil, you know, and I think the agenda's been pretty much working the way they want. They have the power, they have the money, and they have everyone thinking that it's too difficult to think about these things, it's too complicated, you know, there's too many obstacles, how can we fight them, you know, all of these kinds of things.
Yeah.
They're very disempowered. And I think if you judge it by the psychological sort of power of the human race, then I don't think they have any worries.
And you know, I mentioned that because of the, you know, the kind of the timetable leading up towards 2012, and it seems like, you know, we have two different paths to go here. I mean, on the one hand, we have the awakening humanity, and on the other, we have the dumbing down of humanity and into this slave state. And I mentioned to you in a mail I sent earlier regarding the planet Pluto, because I know that you've been talking about this.
Oh, yeah.
The importance of this planet in the coming, I don't know if it's months or even years ahead, I don't know here, but it seems now that the official astronomical world have deleted this as a planet now. And, I mean, does this mean anything to you?
Well, that's some incredible stuff that's been happening recently. And, of course, it just concerned me. It's of interest to me symbolically that they're drawing attention to the planet Pluto, because Pluto, as we know, has a great significance for the time to come.
Yeah.
In November of this year, Pluto crosses galactic center. So nothing could be more important astrologically. And it's not by accident that just, you know, 2-3 months before that episode takes place, or 4 or 5 months or whatever.
Yeah.
They're starting to focus attention on the planet Pluto while at the same time diminishing its relevance.
Yeah, exactly.
So we've actually got two things going on at the same time, if you look at this thing symbolically. You have them drawing attention, which is like you're turning somebody around to face them in the direction that you want them to look at.
Mm.
Because the Illuminati and these individuals have certain rituals and pacts that they have. And these rituals involve, saying it very simply, that they have to tell the victim what is going on.
Yeah.
And you'll notice that through the media and through the ad copy and through different symbolic means,
yeah,
they're always telling us what in fact is going on.
But I mean, so, is that part of, kind of like the ritual, or is there some kind of empowerment on their part in this, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very much part of the ritual. In some sort of black mass ritual type thing that they do, you have to either get the victim's complicity. Meaning he's got to be a willing victim.
Okay.
I mean, nobody forces soldiers and military guys to go off to die. You know, those people sign up, they dress in the uniforms, they want the medal, they want the honor and the glory.
Yeah.
They are mind controlled into hating the enemy, and then they go out of their own free will and murder and massacre each other. So wars, are basically people doing it of their own accord.
Yeah.
We spoke a couple of shows ago about the total irony of the Irish Guards and the Irish battalions fighting for the British army.
Yeah.
After the British have just raped and mutilated and murdered their people. I mean,
yeah.
So, obviously a lot of this is by choice.
Mm.
You know, so the point is that, it's just they need to symbolically tell us what's going on so that they get our complicity as victims. They're not putting the gun to the head. This is a total, as David Icke has said so many times, it's the sheep dog. And the shepherd,
yeah.
and the whistle,
yeah.
technique, and this is how they do it. Now, Pluto is what Pluto means symbolically, and it would take a whole show to go into exactly what that means. But if people read my article called Shiva, the Holy Spirit, and the Age of Aquarius on the Taroscope's website, or they listen to the free web stream, 2012, the Future of Mankind, they'll get an understanding that it's what Pluto represents symbolically. That is why these individuals are suddenly out of the blue start focusing on Pluto. Pluto represents Shiva, and Shiva represents the Holy Spirit. It's all tied up with the symbolism of the astrological sign Scorpio.
Yeah.
Psychologically, it represents the underworld cycle. It represents the cleansing process of the psyche. It represents that which is hidden. It represents the spiritual agencies that come in to deconstruct everything that is false. It represents the unconscious, that part of us which is, connected to the soul.
Mm.
So when you have people out there, these scientists, telling you that it suddenly doesn't exist or it doesn't matter anymore, it's not the physical rock up in space that they're really referring to. It's a collective denial situation.
Yeah.
If enough people believe that Superman, Sherlock Holmes, and Robin Hood existed, then they did exist, if everyone believes it.
Yeah.
The human mind can, create every kind of fantasy that it wants. In fact, 99-point-something% of people have been living in a fantasy from the moment they've been born to the time they die.
Yeah.
Never, ever encountered real reality at all. So what they have inside their heads is an idea of reality.
Yeah.
So what we have here is a collective denial going on. Pluto represents great, enormous change. Change to what? Change to the ego. Change to all that is false. So the people who are false and who are driven by the ego are going to want to deny the existence of that archetype.
Uh-huh. Mm.
See, so it's very connected to what's happening in the psyche. But at the same time, it's paradoxical. You have to attract our attention to it, while at the same time saying it's no longer there. It doesn't mean anything. To do that is because the kinetic battery of the mind leaks off a lot of energy. When you attract the human consciousness to something on a mass level, just like the crop circles phenomena did, and anything that focuses a lot of mental energy releases a lot of mental psychokinetic energy. So they want us to become conscious of Pluto. With one hand, they're drawing attention to the planet Pluto, knowing that that will awaken within us certain archetypal responses. Then at the same time, they're downing it. You see, so there's a lot of, it's almost like a sort of a magical play of lights here.
Yeah.
There's a reason why they're addressing the concept of Pluto. And by the way, in Western astrology, in some Western astrological systems, Pluto is exalted in the house of Leo, and it was in Leo when they started addressing this thing about Pluto.
Interesting.
It seems that there's also, they're doing it, you know, we're in Virgo now, as the last 5 days we've been in Virgo. But about 2 weeks ago or 7 days ago when this started, this whole thing, it was in Leo that they brought it up. And actually Pluto has in Western astrology a strong connection to Leo.
Ah, okay. Yeah, and let's tie that back to, I think, what J.P. Morgan, who said, you know, for those who don't, you know, believe in astrology or whatever, he said that, you know, millionaires don't use astrology, billionaires do.
That's right, billionaires do. And of course, he was not talking about the street level, you know, sort of vendor, you know, theme park type of astrology. He's talking about the very high end, you know, stuff that the Vatican use, that the high wizards of Vatican City and the people who are working behind the crown.
Yes.
And the people who design the cities of the world like Paris, Cologne, and Washington. You know, we're talking very high level sidereal astrology here, which is not the same thing as the kind of fortune-telling gobbledygook, you know, that's mostly what people think of as astrology.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, do you want to briefly just, you know, what do you think that we, some of the changes are going to be in November, December, as we progress towards?
That's hard to say. I mean, it's going to be a continuation of what the changes already have been happening, which is that, basically it's like this. Pluto brings about the time to examine the inner world as opposed to the outer reality. Pluto asks you to look at the roots of things. It asks you to look at the underside of reality, and it asks you to look very deeply at your emotions and what kind of negative emotional attachments that you have, and it asks you to sever those. So it's not going to be something that is just collective in nature. It's also going to be individual. And these changes will come in individually, depending on the lifestyle of the person. What it does is it exposes corruption, it exposes immorality and lack of virtue. It exposes everywhere where there's dirt that's built up that is not looked at. You know, so that's going to be different for everyone. Everybody has a different level of toxicity, everybody has a different level of denial.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, as we know, as any homeopathic doctor will tell you, just before there's a period of healing, there's also a period of a lot of toxic release.
Yeah.
So I expect to be seeing that. I expect this thing to take a very psychological,
a dark night.
I think it's going to take a very psychological tone, so we're going to see a lot more sickness. We're going to see a lot more schizophrenia. We're going to see a lot more neurosis and paranoia. You know, we're already seeing paranoia on the government level. People were paranoid about Saddam Hussein when he wasn't even the slightest threat to this country.
Yeah.
You know, now they're paranoid about the Iranians, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, it's just, it's going to be these psychic things, unhealthy psychotic states that you're going to start seeing. So you will start to see breakdown, but the breakdown will be much more on a psychological level first. That's what I predict anyway, that, you know, because remember, this is a cycle that lasts until about 2012.
Yeah.
You know, if you go by the Mayan concept.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and this is like a, you know, virus now spreading all over the place, and I think that the collective collective mind of humanity, Western world, anyway, this that you mentioned, the paranoia, because everything is a threat, and I mean the latest terror plot thing in the UK is just, you know, an extension of all this, I think. So
sure it is. You know, somebody fiddles around with a cell phone on an aircraft, and now they turn the aircraft around, take it back, and flood the whole aircraft with police.
Yeah.
Because some guy was, you know, twiddling the knobs on his cell phone. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
That's called paranoia.
Indeed.
Now, paranoia is in the mind of everybody. It's already pretty much rampant in society, and it's not going to continue more. And it's going to affect people's relationships. When distrust breaks out amongst thieves, it's the worst situation possible, isn't it? Because nobody trusts each other.
Yeah.
You see, because what you're doing is you're seeing your own criminality in somebody else. You know, you're projecting, you're saying that somebody's attacking you, so then you think that your attacks on them are justified.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot of paranoia, there's a lot of double, there's a lot of contradictoriness.
Yeah.
A lot of just accusation and aggression. You know, Pluto does rule, massive upheaval. The positive side of Pluto is that you can see where your negative emotional patterns are. You can see how you're using other people to fill your emptiness.
Yeah.
Or that you're escaping from, you know, the true virtues of life, and then you can put an end to it. Pluto has a positive aspect as well. It says, can you make radical changes in your life? Can you make radical, you know, metamorphic changes so that you live up to your highest caliber, that you learn to fall in love with the word no, you start to stand up for yourself, and can you end your fear? Can you end your paranoia? Can you say, what is it that I'm really afraid of? Why do I live a life of anxiety?
Yeah.
It's like I keep talking about in my work. Can people start to see that these dark guardians, the anxiety, the loneliness, the fear, these are all sorts of guards or guides that are telling you that something's wrong in the body politic?
Yeah.
Can you start listening to them and saying, okay, look, I'm going to heed you, and I'm going to now analyze what it is that I think may be wrong in my life? Is it because I'm being bossed around and I let people, you know, cross my boundaries? Is it because I'm totally addicted to the approval of other people? Is it because I think that they have something that I need that I can't provide for myself?
Yeah.
Is it because I got people around me that I've given my love and my trust to, and therefore I just assume that they're giving me the same thing back? You see, we're living in a constant state of illusion. We prefer delusion.
Yeah.
You know, people that you see as slaves every day driving from 4 o'clock in the morning in their cars, you know, to these 9-to-5 jobs.
Yeah.
The basis of all of that lie, Henrik, is fear.
It is.
People think they're not going to be provided for, you know, that the truth, the divine guides are not going to help them find their own unique expression.
Exactly.
They're afraid to step out of the box. They're afraid to contact the spirit guides. They're afraid to live spontaneously. They're afraid to think mutably.
So, I mean, is this, this period demand of us to not be afraid of these changes, and to, you know, get past this, we have to first recognize what is part of our, you know, darker side, so to speak, and then change accordingly. Is that the thing you're saying here?
Yeah, you put it in a perfect nutshell. The main theme of any kind of plutonic action in a person's life, and remember, there are certain people, see, planet Pluto is coming into the zodiac into a prominent place, so the energy of Pluto is now going to affect the world. But there's some individuals who have Pluto very strongly in their chart, and they're going through this all the time. So there's already people who know what I'm talking about, because they have Pluto or Scorpio very, very prominently in their chart, and those poor people, you know exactly what I'm talking about, because their lives are dominated by this archetype, and they know very deeply about what you just said.
Yeah.
The idea is that there is a deconstructive cycle in nature.
Yeah.
In the year, we have the winter cycle. In the psyche, we want to live in the one-season world of the summer all the time.
Yeah.
What that means is that you become declimatized to the winter cycle within yourself. And our society, the advertisements, the whole Apollonian type of mindset of our world prevents us from going through these deep cycles. One could argue and say women are closer to it than men, because women do, you know, get pregnant. They have the menstrual cycle and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, I don't even really believe that too much. I think that most people try to live in a one-season cycle in which it's a very masculine, solar, super-lit world.
Yeah.
And they are very deeply disconnected from the organic and from the body, from their libido, from their sexuality, from nature.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, Pluto comes in to restore it, so there's nothing negative about that. It's trying to reconnect you to the inner life, to the life that's inner-directed, to the natural cycle. And part of that natural cycle is that things must end, particularly
yeah.
those things that are not sustainable in the first place.
Yeah.
Now, you take that up to the higher level, take it you know, to the macro level, and then you have the whole question about the decline of civilization itself.
Exactly.
That not only do small emotional patterns in people's individual lives have to end, but there's also on a higher level the decline of civilization. I mean, Oswald Spengler.
Yeah.
You know, get on the internet, people who are listening to this, and read up on Oswald Spengler, the great you know, historian who's a self-taught historian who spoke about the rise of civilization, that it comes to its peak and then it you know, it perishes. I connect that to the life and death of the ego, that the ego literally is something that has a life. An individual is born. It's very easy to understand.
Yeah.
A human being is born as a baby, grows to maturity, and then dies. And the ego is the Superman. The ego is the Anthropos.
Hmm.
The ego is the God-man. And the ego also has a birthday, you know, a maturity, and then a death day.
Hmm.
And I believe we may be living in Pisces, the whole sign of Pisces, which we are very close to the end of Pisces now.
Yeah.
I believe that we may have gone through the 12 cycles of the hero, and we may be now moving into the closing cycle of the ego of man itself. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, consciousness dies, because consciousness is more than the ego.
Yeah.
But it may mean that the ego itself goes through a massive transformation, and everyone who's got their life has been built by the ego, then that is going to perish. But that perishment is correct. That perishment is not something to be lamented.
Yeah.
You know, cycle of closure, just like they show in the movie Fight Club, there is a time when, you know, the drama of the ego must end and the whole of society must crumble and be burned down.
Yeah.
If it is too brittle, then it breaks, and then there's a catastrophic breaking.
Yeah.
But if there is a reverent, ritualistic, shamanic understanding of the death cycle and what that means, then there is a completely different type of action. And it does mean, as you said, ending one's fear of things that are natural.
Hmm.
Fear only arises when there is a resistance to the natural, when somebody is trying to maintain or perpetuate something that is highly unnatural.
Yeah.
Or when somebody is trying to face, or trying to prevent themselves from facing something about themselves, you see, but just as the movie V for Vendetta was showing,
yeah.
just like so many other movies and so many other philosophers are showing, that if you have fear, then you can expect to be chained up by the master and led like a dog.
Yeah.
Fear is what makes people, you know, into slaves.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's very important. I'm glad that we, you know, got to this part and got through that, because I think it's important now in the, you know, as the months goes forward here, and I mean,
right.
time
well,
moves
lots, you know,
so fast.
I've written that article that people can read to find out the exact meaning of this, because Pluto is not just some. If somebody doesn't like the astrological aspect of it, they
yeah.
can't get their minds around that at all, then just in your mind's eye, consider that Pluto represents what the Christians are talking about is the Holy Spirit.
Hmm.
And you need to educate yourself into what that connection is. You know, they can go to Taroscopes, to the High Windows page, and there's an article there called Shiva, the Holy Spirit, and the Age of Aquarius.
Yeah.
I want people to read that like it's their Bible. You know what? That's the homework, is to get on there and read that, or they can watch the web stream, 2012, The Future of Mankind, where I go into a little bit more of the detail about what Pluto and the Holy Spirit connection is, because that thing that the Gnostics, long before Christianity existed, there was a knowledge of the Holy Guardian Angel, the Holy Spirit. And it was very much connected to this deconstructive cycle. It was connected to the Celtic Isis, and it was connected to Shiva, and it's connected to Durga, the Kali, and it's connected to the cycle of regeneration, that is the winter cycle. And not just people who are Scorpios or Aquarians. Everyone needs to understand this, because it's representing something in the subconscious, unconscious connections of human beings. It's very much involved with the changes ahead, and people can either get savvy or they can start, you know, they can shiver under the bed if they want. But these changes are going to happen. It's either acclimatize to it and be ready and willing,
yeah,
or just, you know, just perish is basically the answer.
All right, excellent. Yeah, go and check that out. You know, taroscopes.com, and there's a lot of material on there. So, Michael, do you want to, you know, should we, you know, dive into something about the pharaohs here, or where do you want to,
yeah.
you know, take our serious here, so to speak?
Well, last time we were talking about the Jewish question, the Levites, and showing just who the Levites really were, and that the Levites the whole story goes back to the Israelite pharaohs of Egypt, which people have to understand is that there was Israelite pharaohs of Egypt, and you're going to need to know this stuff, because when you're reading about the story of Jesus or Moses or Abraham, so many scholars, you know, are trying to find out the origins of Jesus, who he was, and they're doing this because they know that the Bible just simply doesn't cut it anymore. Most of the gospel stories have been, you know, most of the accounts of Jesus' life have been negated now,
yeah,
as either forgeries or completely unhistorical. And so, you know, people are trying to, they're very reticent, the scholars, to go back to Egypt and go back to Ireland to show exactly where these ancient connections are. You know, we were saying in an earlier program about the great Sigmund Freud.
Yeah.
Sigmund Freud was one of the first people to ask this question about, was Moses Akhenaten?
Yeah.
That's, you know, in his book Moses and Monotheism, he was the one who really asked this question first, and my work very much follows on from him. I think if we have a moment, I'd like to read two small passages from Sigmund Freud's book.
Yeah.
Moses and Monotheism. The first caption, he says, among the greatest riddles of Jewish prehistoric times is that concerning the antecedents of the Levites. Right, this is the famous 13th tribe.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The elite within the Jewish movement. Because it's these elite that we're talking about and not the average Jewish person.
Yes.
We're not talking about the ordinary Jews and the ordinary rabbis and the ordinary traditions of Judaism.
Mm.
We're not implicating any of this. We're talking about a hidden hand. The same hidden hand that is behind Christianity, is behind Freemasonry, and is behind Judaism. So,
yeah.
And the Jews, like the Christians and everybody, are suffering from the manipulations of this hidden hand. They're not the perpetrators. They are themselves victims of this elite.
Yeah.
So he's saying, they are said to have been derived from one of the 12 tribes of Israel, the tribe of Levi. But no tradition has ever ventured to pronounce on where that tribe originally dwelt, or what portion of the conquered country of Canaan had allotted to it.
Hmm.
Remember when the tribes left Egypt and went to Israel, went to Jerusalem,
yeah,
they divided the land amongst themselves. But Freud is saying that the Levites has not even told to us what land became theirs.
Hmm.
They occupied the most important priestly positions, but yet they were distinguished from the priests. A Levite is not necessarily a priest. It is not the name of a caste. And then in another place he says, tradition maintains that Moses was a Levite. This seems a transparent distortion of the actual state of affairs. The Levites were Moses' people. In the last times, we find Egyptian names only amongst the Levites.
Hmm.
So he's saying that only the Levites, even their names are Egyptian. His point being, I think what he maybe understood, or what certainly now needs to come to light, is that the people that were called the Levites are, in fact, descendants of the ancient Egyptian pharaonic houses.
Yeah.
And once it's understood that Moses was, in fact, Akhenaten, then everything is cleared up. Because the great problem with many of the writers who are writing on this issue of Moses was that they, even the ones who have dated Moses to the Egyptian times, they think that he is a separate character of Akhenaten.
Yeah.
Okay, so when people are reading these books, they will often find writers who are saying, yes, we understand that Moses, of course, he was raised in the houses of the pharaohs, and he was brought up in Egypt. But what you have to understand and never forget is that Moses is not a separate character than Akhenaten. It's not just that he was brought up in Egypt, he lived in Egypt, he was an Egyptian prince or whatever.
Yeah.
Even that is still far, far, far from the point. And we now need to understand that when they're talking about Moses, which is a word that just meant the son of somebody, it's an Egyptian term,
okay.
That he is actually talking about Akhenaten himself. Now, if we go through a little bit of the timeline, you'll find something interesting. Let me see. Taking a look here.
Yeah, sure, no problem.
Well,
yeah.
Here we have, and we have the question of Jesus. In the Hebrew Talmud, the Hebrews have always maintained that Jesus was a magician who practiced magic in Egypt. That's in the Talmud.
Yeah.
Because my work is showing that Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah, is born of the house of Judah or the house of David, just like the Jews say.
Yeah.
But half the Jews are saying that without even knowing what the house of David is.
Hmm.
The house of David is nothing more than the Israelite pharaohs of Egypt.
Yeah.
The house of Judah, the house of David, is a reference, a coded reference.
I mean,
the six-pointed hexagram that is used by the Jews today is the old symbol of the god Aton, as a symbol of the sun.
Mm.
Of course, the Jews do talk about Adon. Their Yahweh is called Adon, or Adonai,
yeah,
which is just a spelling of the word Aton.
Hmm.
Now, the other thing is that Jews and Christians believing that monotheism is unique to them, that there's something, you know, incredible about Moses or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, when we understand that, wait a minute, Moses is Akhenaten, then it's dismissed any concept that he is the creator of monotheism.
Yeah.
Or that the Jews have something unique there. Monotheism was being preached in Egypt thousands of years before they were ever born.
Yeah.
In fact, it's well known that the first temple to Aton was actually constructed by Thutmosis IV.
Hmm.
He's the grandfather of Akhenaten. And then Akhenaten's father, Amenhotep III, he's a very, very important figure because in the Dramatis Personae that has now been discovered, he is the prototype for the original Solomon.
All right, okay.
All right, so Amenhotep III I would say that along with Akhenaten, it is this Amenhotep III, his own father, that was an extremely important person to study.
Hmm.
Well, it's his father that opened the first temple. And guess where that temple was, Henrik? It was in a place called Goshen, the famous Hebrew Goshen, the land of Goshen.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where the first temple of the sun was built by Thutmosis IV.
Hmm. All right.
So even hundreds of years before Akhenaten lived, monotheism was already well established. Temples were already being built.
Michael, I don't know if, I mean, this might not be relevant, but you know, the stories about Moses going up to the mountain, and I mean, do you think that there are references between that the mountain is the Great Pyramid and so forth?
Well, there's no doubt about it. The symbol of the mountain, but the other idea is that, you see, there was a very important distortion and deception being perpetrated. We have to understand that the kind of interplay, the kind of secrecy, the kind of rule when Akhenaten was king in Egypt is very different from the rule after he is made an exile.
Hmm. Yeah.
Okay, their operating procedures are totally different. After they were thrown out of Egypt and they made the famous move towards Sinai, it was very important for them to disguise the fact that the god that they were worshipping was the Egyptian god Aton.
Yeah.
So the biblicists, the people who wrote the story later, the people who sat down to compose in writing as opposed to an oral tradition, decided to concoct the story that focuses on Mount Sinai and the god Jehovah.
Yeah.
The god Jehovah is a very modern god. It is much later than the god Aton, okay?
Hmm.
And Jehovah was a god of the outlying areas. He was only worshipped by very, very low-class people. He was only worshipped by very, very select farming, shepherd-type people in Arabia.
Hmm.
And Jehovah is mostly of an Arabian creation. That's the mountains, not Sinai itself, but other mountains near there, they worship the famous volcano gods.
So yeah.
Very, very, simple people worship these gods.
Yeah.
So Yahweh was adopted. This is very important to understand that the chosen people, who we now understand were Egyptian exiles, who were trying to, and later on when their story was written down, instead of saying, hey, Moses worshipped Aton, they said Moses worshipped Yahweh. This is a smokescreen.
Mm.
Yahweh was nothing more than a simple, unimportant volcano god, and anyone who's done their homework knows that.
Mm.
But this would help to create the disguise, you see, that they were worshipping Aton. Now, also, there was a lot of falling out between the exiles, and the falling out had already been happening within Egypt. And the man that talks about this is Ralph Ellis. Ralph Ellis draws our attention to the fact that these Egyptian exiles were always in conflict with the ruling class in Egypt, and they also had a lot of conflict in amongst themselves, and it had to do with an astrological change from the house of Taurus into the house of Aries.
Hmm.
And it would be too long to explain on this show, so people need to go to the astrotheology pages and read up on it and get into Ralph Ellis's work, who explains that, you see, there was already a schism within the priestarchies between those who were acknowledging that the sun had moved into the sign of Aries and therefore a different god had to be worshipped.
Yeah.
Or those who said, no, we're sticking with the old system where he's in Taurus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is very important because Ralph Ellis says that when the Hebrews, the so-called Israelites, got to Jerusalem, they divided into two houses. Remember, the tribe of Judah in the south and the 10 tribes of Israel in the north.
Yeah, yeah.
He is saying that that split happened, Hendrik, precisely because of this astrological phenomena.
Ah, I see.
And no other reason.
Hmm.
And it's also the conflict, he says, that at Mount Sinai had the people, you know, backslide. Moses says that his people backslid into worshiping the golden calf.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, the golden calf is the symbol of the age of Taurus.
Yes.
And Akhenaton, or Moses, was telling them, look, you people, my God, Aton has moved into the house of Aries, and we're meant to worship the lamb, the ram. That's why they talk about the ram's blood being put onto the doors of the houses.
Yeah, blowing the shofar.
Astrologically, the houses, the God has moved into the house of Aries, and there were certain rituals that went with that.
Yeah.
This is also very important to understand that the Israelites had divisions amongst themselves.
Hmm.
But in order to really understand anything about this dynasty, we have to go back to the Hyksos kings. These were people who invaded Egypt in the 13th dynasty.
Yeah.
Okay, they arrived about the year 1783 BC, and they set up the 13th and 14th dynasty. It's a little confusing because the 13th and the 14th dynasty ran at the same time. They ran concurrently.
Hmm.
It's just a botch-up that the historians make. Believe me, historians do not want people to know what we're talking about on this show. So they have had enormous amount of cover-ups and mix-ups and purposely distorting the dates and purposely mixing up the dynasties, you see, so that people are totally confused. It was Sigmund Freud and Velikovsky and some other writers that really started to fix this for us. But the Hyksos people arrived, and they were extremely barbaric, and they suppressed the whole of Egypt. Now, the person that we know as Abraham was one of their kings.
Mm.
So even if we're not able to get into the whole dramatis personae today, let's just understand one thing. Abraham and his sons, like Jacob, right?
Yeah.
Like Joseph, like Isaac, the whole cult, him and his wife Sarah, these are not just some wandering vagabonds. These are a dynasty of pharaohs who overtook Egypt.
Yeah.
And one of the greatest lies has been this. We'll get later on to the biggest cover-up that was ever perpetrated. Remember in the Masonic degrees, we have the Prince of the Royal Secret or the Keepers of the Royal Secret?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if people are listening in the next 20 minutes, they're going to find out what that royal secret was. But more than one of the most important, maybe the second biggest secret, is that the people that we know as the Abraham, his sons Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph, are pharaohs. We can't elaborate any more because there's no time, but if people go to the website, they can find this out, that these are not merely guests of the Egyptians.
Yeah.
These were the Egyptians. They were a people. For instance, there's a Reverend Jack Moore says something interesting about Abraham. He says, it has often been stated from the pulpits of Christian churches that Abraham was the first Jew.
Yeah.
The Bible, however, never calls Abraham by that term for a good reason. The word Jew is merely a modern English contraction for the word Judahite or Judean. Thus, the question is not really whether Abraham was a Jew or not, but whether Abraham was a Judite.
Hmm.
So when we're talking about Levites and Judites, we are now talking about a pharaonic dynasty that ruled in Egypt for about 300 years.
Hmm.
They were fabulously wealthy, and they oppressed most of the whole of Egypt. They lived in the Western Delta area.
Hmm.
Now, Abraham and Sarah, right, they made their initial journey into Egypt. The official report is that they came in after the Hyksos rule, when Thutmosis III was the pharaoh, the sixth pharaoh of the 18th dynasty. Now, here's the key. It was he who married Sarah and fathered Isaac, meaning Thutmosis III.
Hmm.
On the death of Isaac, the elder of the twins, Esau, sold his birthright, the title as the Prince of Egypt, cheaply to the younger one, Jacob. And from Jacob, that line passed to his son, Joseph, okay?
Hmm.
So Joseph, the man of the many coat of many colors, which is already a catchphrase for a priest of the sun. When they talk about Joseph having the coat of many colors, that's a code word, just like the word carpenter is a code word. When you hear that Jesus was a carpenter, that means mason.
Yeah.
That means somebody who has knowledge of the building of the architecture of the pyramids.
Yeah.
When Joseph is born of 12 brothers, that means he's of an astrological lineage.
Yeah.
That means he's of a sacred tribe, a people who are worshippers of the stars. But they're telling you in a coded way. When they're telling you that he had the coat of many colors and so on.
Yeah.
Now, the biggest secret, let's get to it right away, is that this king thought Moses III, who Ahmed Osman and Mustafa Gedala has discovered, is, in fact, the biblical Solomon. He is the man who marries with Abraham's wife, Sarah. Because for those who do not know, when Abraham gets to Egypt, they say that the Pharaoh of the time fell in love with Sarah's beauty. And Abraham, this wonderful, holy man of God, tells the Pharaoh that she's not my wife, she's my daughter. It's just one of the many scandalous things in the Old Testament that people think is so wonderfully holy. They never ask, why is it that this man of God, who's being guided by God, tells a blatant lie to the Pharaoh and says, no, this is just my daughter, not my wife. It's in the scriptures. People are going to go and read it. Well, the true story is, though, that she was his wife. But she was also, a very prince, a queen. In fact, the word in Hebrew means, Sarah means princess. Now, the hidden story, though, is that Joseph, Jacob, and Isaac are not the sons of Abraham. They're the sons of the Pharaoh, Thutmose III, who ruled from 1490 to 1436 B.C. That is the great secret. The Masons and everybody else has hidden that the elite Jews, not the ordinary Jews, are not going to know this, just like the average Christian or the average person listening to our show is not going to know any of this.
Yeah.
But this is the secret, my friend, that the Masons are keeping, that you can forget about Abraham, the Hyksos king, or the person that they put before you in the Bible. No, Isaac, Jacob, the 12 tribes, the father of the 12 tribes is actually the Pharaoh, the Egyptian Pharaoh of the 18th dynasty, Thutmose III.
So this
what would that mean? Wow. That would mean one thing is why the Hebrews, the Jews, have always been silent about their connection to Egypt.
Yeah.
Why they don't mention the ruling Pharaoh of the time when they're talking about the Exodus.
Yeah.
They never mention the Pharaoh at the time. They don't want to leave you a timeline where there's the incredible concoction that Moses is just a boy found on the river in a basket of reeds and nonsense and just happens to float down and the Pharaoh's princess just happens to see him in the water. All that nonsense.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah. That Moses is just some wanderer. That Jacob is just thrown into a pit by his evil 12 brothers. And then is instantly promoted from a guy who's in a jail in Egypt. He's meant to answer the... First of all, somebody tells the pharaohs that there's a guy rotting in jail who can analyze your dreams. That the Egyptian pharaoh does not have the greatest, mystics, magicians, and soothsayers, people who can build pyramids, but they can't answer the pharaoh's dreams.
Yeah.
A culture that's over 25,000 years old, but they can't find a dream interpreter. They got to go to some dungeon and dig out Joseph. He'll do it for you.
Yes, there we have it. The fascination, with the pyramid and the eye and all the symbolism right there.
That's right.
Think so.
The symbolism is the biggest giveaway.
Michael, do you want to fire away the question? We have about just 10 minutes left here.
The question is simple. Now we're talking about the question has to do with the Essenes. The Essenes. This is a group of people who preserved a pure understanding of the Messiah and of Judaic tradition. You see, St. Paul concocted a Roman version of Christianity. Okay, so the Gospels, the New Testament, Jesus, is a sort of concoction that is very applicable to Western people. Somebody was sitting down and re-scripting the Jesus Messiah tradition so that Gentiles and pagans of the West would be accepting this because St. Paul was known to have been funded by the Romans. It's some writers even speculating that it was Roman Caesars and Roman emperors who were funding the creation of the gospel stories.
Yeah.
But they They may have re-scripted the story of the Messiah, but they didn't invent it. The story of the Messiah, the story of the coming of the seed of David, was always preserved within Judaic tradition, within Jewish tradition for many, many, many hundreds and hundreds of years before Rome ever came on the scene. And one of the groups that preserved it, we know them from the Dead Sea Scrolls, the people who preserved a more traditional understanding of Jesus and carried it down through the ages, were the Essenes. People know about the Essenes. Now, the Essenes had a name, Henrik, for their leader. Mm. They didn't just refer to their, you know, Jesus as a Christ. So the contest question is, what was the name of the Messiahs or the leaders of the Essenes? When the Essenes talked about the Son of God and when they talked about the initiators, they had a special title that they used for their leaders and for their messianic figures.
Mm.
And if somebody can give us the right answer on that,
yeah,
and they can win the prize.
All right, right. Yeah, we got two DVDs left here. So, I mean, we have not much time left, but we can take calls in the last few minutes here. So if you're in the U.S., you should call this number, 877-876-5227. And if you're outside the U.S., simply call 001-888-810-8322, and these numbers are available at bbsradio.com, so check that out. And also I can squeeze this in one here, that if we don't get a call right now or a correct answer, the contest continues, so mail me with your answer. The mail address is radio@redicecreations.com, and you'll find that address on red-ice.net as well. So yeah, let's continue along there, Michael. The fascination with Egypt and the symbology and that's where we get all this from, and that is what connects. Do we have a caller already? No caller. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. What's your name? What are you calling from?
It's Daniel, and I'm in France.
In France?
In the Czech Republic, yeah.
Oh, in the Czech Republic. Oh, hi, welcome. Do you have
an answer to the competition?
Yeah, sure.
Go ahead.
Is it the star?
Yeah, you're right.
There we go.
Good.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was on the website. I'm glad you found it.
Excellent,
yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's what I was saying, of course.
Yeah, the star was the word, which again, I wanted to have a question like that to emphasize the fact that these original Judaic peoples were also very into astrology. If they're calling their leader the star, you know, they're heavy into astrology,
yeah.
Because Jesus even himself is referring to himself as the morning star. So, you know, we have to understand that there's a lot of astrology, a lot of astromancy involved in the symbolism, you know, Egyptian or Hebrew or Christian. We're talking stars here.
Yeah.
That's absolutely the right answer, Daniel. Thank you.
Excellent, excellent.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah. I'll look forward to watching the DVD.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, and talk to Henrik online so that you can, you know, choose which one of the DVDs you want.
Exactly. Daniel, drop me a mail.
Thank you very much, Michael. Keep up the good work.
Will do.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, excellent. There we go. Right answer, right from the get-go. So, excellent.
Absolutely excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good that those DVDs are getting out there.
Indeed. All right. We have about, you know, my God, time moves so fast. We have, you know, just about 4 minutes left here. But do you want to, you know, tie all this together? Is that possible?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, people need to... I just want to make sure that when people are, you know, checking into this, you know, we have to realize that when other scholars are writing on this subject and trying to place Moses, that we're talking about is the Egyptian pharaoh Akhenaten. Let's just get that one piece of information very clearly understood, because the one limitation with that Sigmund Freud, he did not exactly say that Moses was Akhenaten. He believed that Moses was a priest in the circle around Akhenaten.
Hmm.
So, you know, this theory, you will find that difficult when you go out there to read it, because a lot of people who are writing on this subject also take that line. They take the line that, you know, Moses may have been connected to Akhenaten. He certainly seemed to be borrowing the monotheism idea. You know, so let's cut through all of that and just get it very clear for now that Moses was Akhenaten. That will help, you know, clarify a great deal, and that you're dealing with some kind of a smokescreen situation here that has been kept for a very long time. Then we have to understand that the last thing that we covered today, and we'll pick up on that next time, is that these the great secret, believe me, the great Masonic secret, is that the fact that the 12 tribes of Israel and Jacob and Joseph and Abraham, the key here is Sarah. The word means princess. She was married, actually was basically the concubine of a pharaoh, a ruling pharaoh that's known to all Egyptologists, Thutmose III. And we'll pick up with the story next time. But that means something incredible then. It means that the 12 tribes of Israel are deeply connected to Egypt. And this has enormous consequences for everything to do with the rise of Judeo-Christianity. And it's something that has been wanted to be hidden. And then the smokescreen of creating the Jehovah Front. All the true Kabbalists, all the top Judaic wizards know absolutely full well the difference between Adonai and the difference between Yahweh. And you, as a Jewish person, and you as a Christian, are not meant to know that. The average Jew is not going to be told that. The average Christian is not going to be told that. The Aton concept, you know, that it's a sun cult, is not going to be, you know, visited on the average person verbally. But it will be told to them symbolically.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? In the wafer, in the chalice, in the symbolism, in the halos, you know, in the cult of the sun, in the walking on the water, in the calling of the leaders of the Essenes and the Gnostics, the star, in the crown of thorns, the list is endless.
Yeah.
The bringing of the gold and the three wise men at the Nativity.
Yeah.
You see?
Excellent.
All the different sayings and aphorisms that we find in the Bible, the incredible wealth of astrology. You know, I'm reading book after book after book on the subject of the ancestry and the origin of Jesus, and not one of them, any of these scholars, ever mentions that it's a solar myth. That it's basically, you don't look to historical origins for this man. And if they're telling you that his father, Joseph, is a carpenter, then we have to know what that means astrologically. We have to know what that means from a Masonic point of view.
Yeah, let's go into that next time, Michael.
And, we'll do that.
Yeah, that would be excellent. And I mean, thank you very much for today. Thank you for coming on, and this has been excellent.
Always a pleasure. See you next time.
Let's do that. Thank you very much, Michael.
Bye, Henrik.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thank you very much, everyone, for tuning in. We will, continue next week. So check out Michael's website, taroscopes.com or michaeltsarion.com. Don't forget my site, red-ice.net. So this has been Henrik Fangren signing out. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye, everyone.